Israel on edge, preparing for a possible and imminent Iranian strike. The IDF pulls most of its troops out of Gaza, leaving everybody wondering what's next. Hostage deals still stuck. And we talked to two master storytellers on how the war affected their stories and their friendship. It's Unholy. I'm Yonit Levy of Channel 12 in Tel Aviv.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian in London. It's Unholy, two Jews on the news. Well, we have got a lot ahead of us with this huge conversation we're going to have with Ira Glass and Etgar Keret, which is a really something we've wanted to do for a long time. We've spoken to them separately on the podcast. We're going to bring them together, their friendship, how it's been affected, exactly as you say. But front and center in our minds is obviously these warnings of something imminent coming from Iran. I know we're going to get into all of that, but you're going to indulge me because you have told me before we got ourselves in front of these microphones about a really, sort of remarkable kind of encounter in your life, which I'm completely fascinated by. So I think you should tell us about that.
Yeah. So before the Iranian scare, I'm going to go into take you to Time machine 30 years back, sort of escapism into the past. For the first time in my life this Friday, I went to a reunion. Now, you know me. I'm not one for reunions generally. I think the past is in the past for a reason. And anyone looking for proof of that, look no further than Gilmore Girls Revisited. But in this case, it was a really formative experience of my teenage years. And I think it's still relevant to something, everything that's been going on in this country. So 30 years ago, I was part of a delegation called Young Ambassadors. It was an annual project by the Israeli Foreign Ministry in which teenagers were sent off after rigorous exams and interviews, sent off to talk about Israel with other teenagers around the world. So there was about a two-week seminar in Jerusalem, and then each were couple by couple were sent out to talk about Israel. I was sent to Holland, and that was about a month. And I'm telling you all this because the moment in time it happened was right after the Oslo Accords. And in the words of my dear friend and friend from that period, Advah Kieselstein, who wrote this in the Kalkalist Weekend Supplement, it was that kind of moment where we were starting out our adult life and the country was starting out or seemed to be starting out its new future and the convergence of that. And well, I don't need to tell you that obviously things didn't work out exactly as we planned and as we thought. Right when we arrived in our destination countries, we saw, what happened was Baruch Goldstein and the massacre at the Cave of the Patriarchs, and then years and years of terror attacks in the heart of Israeli cities. Hamas, the perpetrator of that as well. Then Rabin was assassinated, and that's how we began our military service. So just, thinking, Jonathan, of what the Israel that we saw in our minds when we were teenagers and the Israel that we see today when we have, some of us have children at the age of military service, it makes you think a little bit about the bunch that we grew up to be. And there are doctors and lawyers and venture capitalists and academics and journalists. And I think we deserved a different story. So I was trying to sort of take us into an escapism route, but I'm not sure I succeeded.
No, not quite. But you gave me a sneak preview of the piece that your friend Advah has written. It's beautifully written, very haunting. One point she makes in there is how many of your group, young ambassadors who are meant to go out in the world representing Israel, are instead out in the world having left Israel. She estimates about a fifth either have gone, emigrated, or have got foreign passports for their children, and so on. It's very sort of poignant and or melancholic, really, is the word I would use. And all I would say is, firstly, I was not a teenager at the time of the Oslo Accords. Instead, I was already working as a journalist covering the diplomacy around them out of Washington in that period. But that period is absolutely sort of haloed in the memory of many diaspora Jews as well, because it was a time when you could feel very optimistic and good about Israel. There was peace was sort of breaking out around the world. Nelson Mandela was out in South Africa, and you had peace talks in Northern Ireland. And it felt as if, okay, Israel was going to get its turn as being one of those places where the conflict was, sorted out. And therefore, I knew of people, contemporaries of mine, who emigrated to Israel at that period, or who decided they would spend a year or two there, and were suddenly seeing it as in a new light. And the contrast, exactly as you say, between then and now is quite marked. But no, I thought there is something cinematic about you and all of your friends being reunited. She writes in the piece that when she describes what all of you have gone on to do, she says this one became head of psychiatry at the hospital, and that one set up a multi-million-dollar business, and Yonit Levy became Yonit Levy, which needs no further explanation. But no, if you're in, you're a Hebrew reader, and you get access to the weekend supplement of Kalkalist, I do recommend that piece. But a poignant set of memories.
Yes, which takes us, it's interesting. We were talking about Iran and Hezbollah 30 years ago, and here we are talking about it again. And in this point in time, actually, it's a very weird feeling that you're living or trying to live a normal life. We still have a war in Gaza, and there's still hostages and evacuees from the north and the south. But the fact that in the last couple of days, there is this feeling of more than a feeling, right? The intelligence services in this country and the Americans all think that an Iranian attack on Israel is indeed imminent. The question is not if, but the question is when. And it's a very strange feeling. Maybe we should talk our listeners through it, just because, what happened and where we are, to sort of set the stage on the fact
And certainly worth talking people through it, partly because until very recently, we're speaking Thursday, middle of the day, until very recently, there was very little international focus or coverage of this, that the coverage outside Israel has been very much still about Gaza and the fallout of last week and the killing of those 7 aid workers with World Central Kitchen, or with the standoff diplomatically between Joe Biden and Netanyahu. And meanwhile, the focus inside Israel is absolutely on the threat, as you describe.
So the background to all this is something that happened about a week and a half ago, an assassination attributed to Israel of a senior Islamic Revolutionary Guard general in Damascus, Mohammad Reza Zahedi. That was viewed by Iran as an attack on Iranian soil. There's an argument whether it happened directly on a consular building of Iran or next to it. But the point is that Iran threatened the minute it happened. And those threats we heard from Amos Harel last week actually surprised. The volume of them actually surprised Israeli intelligence officials. They said, we are going to retaliate. And Iran itself is going to retaliate, not through proxies, not the Houthis in Yemen and not Hezbollah in the north, Iran itself. And now the assessment that's sort of circulating, particularly in the American press, because the Israeli press is more, under a military censorship. So it comes from the international press talking about specifically, when you go through the list, you kind of need to take a breath, right? A large swarm of cruise missiles, several dozen, drones, about 150. That is the plan of the Iranian attack, which will likely target one or more military targets, an Air Force base or a Navy base inside Israel. The fact that we're talking about this almost like it's, I'm not saying normal, but it's a talking point to discuss, just means how, embroiled we are since the war, since October 7th, in these kinds of threats. Again, Iran saying that it is imminent. We see a few of these foreboding signs. Ramadan is over. Joe Biden is saying we will protect Israel. The commander of CENTCOM is coming. Lufthansa has canceled its flights to and from Iran. So these are the signs. And Israelis obviously are, understated, a tad bit concerned of what this might happen. We're talking on a Thursday. It can happen tonight or on Friday or on Saturday. I mean, that's how imminent this thing can be.
Yeah. And the concern is not just at the level of, politics and policymakers. You speak to regular Israelis, they are checking their safe room, they are checking they've got supplies, they think they could be, holed up for a whole period while the country is under bombardment. Just to emphasize what a, huge escalation this would be. When October 7th happened and Joe Biden flew straight away to Israel to stand at Israel's side, and when he delivered that one-word message to Israel's enemies, don't, what he feared and what was in people's minds was the kind of proxy attack you referred to of Hezbollah joining in using its very, very heavy arsenal. The foreign reports you're describing say that very deliberately the decision has been taken to go to skip out that stage, which is a huge deal in itself, and escalate up a notch to the one thing which I think it's fair to say most people almost thought would never happen, which is a direct attack from Iranian soil onto Israeli soil. The reports say that the Supreme Leader has made that decision, almost as if it's, you know, Iran's honor is at stake, and therefore it must come directly via, rather than via an intermediary, as it were. I mean, this obviously would be the most colossal escalation were it to happen. And I think, you know, the sign so far is that Joe Biden is reinforcing the message he gave back in October and saying that the support that Washington gives to Israel is ironclad. Significance of that is this comes just days after he was on the phone to the Prime Minister Netanyahu, essentially saying our support is conditional on you behaving the way we want you to behave in your war with Hamas. So this is one of those situations where, if I can sort of adapt the famous slogan of the Ben-Gurion era, directed then about the British white paper that choked off immigration into Palestine, there is a desire to fight the Iranians as if there was no war with Hamas, and to fight the war with Hamas as if there is no war with the Iranians. In other words, the Americans are going to have a separate policy with Israel, and it gets very complicated, the business of arms. And this is why Joe Biden was very nervous about, you know, heeding those calls to slow down arms supplies, because he thinks Israel needs to be armed to protect itself from a threat which has gone from being possible to now being discussed as if it's probable, if not imminent.
So that is about Iran. We'll probably have more to say about that in our future episodes. But let's talk a little bit about what has been going on with the war in Gaza. So first of all, Netanyahu saying this week that a date has been set to enter Rafah. You know, he has also been saying every evening that we are one step from victory, to the extent that someone wrote on Twitter, Israel is definitely one step away from setting a date to enter Rafah. But seriously, the Americans say they know of no such thing. Military officials will say that any operation in Rafah will take into consideration the American requirements. In the meantime, the Israeli military withdrawing from Khan Yunis either means that they are preparing for the next stage, or that this is a signal in the area of hostage negotiations, hostage release negotiations. Israel reportedly yesterday assassinated the sons of Ismail Haniya, one of the leaders in Hamas, living quite comfortably in Doha, Qatar. And the question, of course, coming from this is, does this help Israel move forward on the issue of hostages? The person who gave the command is the order, is a colonel. This didn't move on to the general staff or Netanyahu himself. It's a decision by the officer in the field. And you do need to ask the question, is this sort of decision at this sort of time, the children of the leader of your enemy, that's not the decision made lightly, even if they are part of the evil league of evil. This is a decision that probably needs to hit the higher level and higher ranks of the IDF, at least. And now Hamas says it does not have hostages to trade in the first state of the deal, which, as I remind you, 40 hostages, the women still in captivity, and the humanitarian, or the injured and the elderly. This is either Hamas, you know, lying to get better terms, or the tragic truth. But right now, in any case, the deal is stuck.
So just a couple of things on that. First, it was his sons and grandsons as well. He immediately, Haniya, came out and thanked Allah for giving him the opportunity of martyrdom for his family members, that this was a great honor, and that he said it would not affect the ceasefire discussions, calculations that Hamas made one way or the other. But as I agree with you, I think it's a decision obviously freighted with significance, and it's a bit astonishing to think that could be just taken by a commander in the field. On the larger things you were saying, it seems to me that Israel is, and Netanyahu particularly, are trying to do something which is going to come unstuck, which is to talk out of both sides of their mouth when it comes to this war with Hamas and in Gaza. On the one hand, the thing that is announced is a retreat from Khan Yunis, or withdrawal really from Gaza altogether, that there's only, you know, one brigade left and so on. Yet on the other hand, and that's very much, you know, in line with what Netanyahu was saying to Joe Biden last week. Then on the other hand, we see a headline, Israeli army launches ground offensive in central Gaza, is, you know, on the front of one of the websites. What I was just going to say, and you correct me on that, but the mixed messaging, so that, for example, all of the messaging around aid being allowed in, the promise to Joe Biden that the Erez is crossing, we're going to do it right now. Joe Biden says to him, I want it done tonight. Meanwhile, reporters who are there on this morning, today, Thursday, as we speak, saying they're looking at Erez crossing, nothing is going through. He needs Netanyahu to keep the sort of Ben-Gvir right of his coalition happy, so he tells them the assault on Rafah is hours away. Meanwhile, he's talking to Washington that are saying, we do not want you to go into Rafah. He's trying to be sort of Janus-faced about this war and face two ways at once, and I just don't see that it's possible or sustainable to keep doing it. And eventually, you know, reality is going to just emerge here. You know, I'm not sure the Israeli public or even the coalition is sort of ready for that, because he's trying to be at two contradictory places at once.
Yeah, well, it's the classic Netanyahu attempt, right, of saying to everyone what they want to hear. And in this case, you have indeed two contradictory promises. One is the, or even threats in a way. One is the American saying, you don't do that, or at least not in the way that we don't want you to. And Ben-Gvir saying, you have to do that or you won't be prime minister. That is what he said this week. And that explains a little of that bizarre, slightly bizarre Netanyahu statement saying, we have set a date to enter Rafah. When have you ever heard the Israeli leader said, we've set a date for the next stage of the war? What is clear now is, again, the military has left Khan Yunus, so for the most part, the IDF is not in Gaza, apart from these raids that you're going to hear about occasionally. And what the IDF is very clear in saying is, we're going to enable the Gazans who fled to Rafah to come back to Khan Yunus, which could be a preparation for an Operation Rafah. And again, all this could also be a smokescreen in preparation for a hostage deal. And this is Israel paying the first price of that, which is saying we are actually withdrawing our troops. Now, I think we should say that there is growing frustration. Whatever the flexibility of what Netanyahu is trying to do here, there is growing frustration with him. Case in point, Nadav Argaman, who was head of the Shin Bet up until a few years ago, in an interview, a scathing interview against Netanyahu to Ilana Dayan on Thursday, saying things like he does not have the moral authority to remain prime minister. He's saying this man cannot yet again even be a nominee for that role. He failed a huge failure on October 7th. And Nadav Argaman also goes to detail the fact that he himself suggested as head of Shin Bet a preemptive strike against the heads of Hamas. Netanyahu said no. He goes on and on, but this is a very, very dense allegation against the leader. Of course, Netanyahu supporters will say this is a leftist who's only attacking the prime minister, but these words have their own weight in the reality that we live in. As I said, there is a growing frustration and a growing, you see it in the streets as well, growing protests against this government and the man who's heading it.
Yeah, I mean, says he cannot be a worthy leader of the Jewish people. It's a devastating stat, but there have been, you know, quite a few of those from that corner of Israeli public life and the sort of security establishment. There's no mystery around that. And yet Netanyahu is still there. It makes me think more and more that the time for that was right at the start, that if he was not worthy of being capable of making these decisions in wartime, Israel had to act swiftly. And I feel as if it's paying quite a price for not pushing Netanyahu out earlier. I do have this concern about those people who joined the war cabinet previously in the opposition, Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot. I see that their sort of poll numbers are beginning to slip. You know, this was the fear I had about that, which is, you know, you think you're going in to save Israel. What actually you do is you save Netanyahu and you pay a price yourself. We talked before, since you're bringing back memories of 30 years ago, of how that delay, the failure to have elections immediately after the Rabin assassination, when there was a national mood, meant that the person who benefited from that was Netanyahu. I think there should have been a move immediately while the anger against Netanyahu, who was white hot on October the 7th, to get him out. And that failure, I think, is proven very costly. Just one last bit of sort of reporting that I picked up was that in Rafah itself and around, there's apparently talk and signs of preparations for victory rallies that Hamas want to stage, as if a ceasefire comes, they will claim it as a victory, that they succeeded in pushing the Israelis out. And that they are still there, still standing, as it were, undefeated. So all of that, should have been in the mix, I think, for some of the decisions that have been taken this week, including the Hania assassination.
And one final word for the history nerds, at least two of us on this conversation. I hope some of our listeners as well. This is the week, 50 years ago, in which Golda Meir resigned. After the Yom Kippur War, she actually won the elections right after the war. But she said she was tormented. It was the Agranat Inquiry Commission with its first conclusions. But after that, she said, enough, I can't do it. And she resigned. So obviously different characters here, but just wanting to mention that as well. If we're going 30 years into the past, why not go 50 years into the past?
Completely. And the timeline is so relevant because, of course, we know the attack was October the 6th, 1973. So by now, the equivalent of by now, there had been elections. Remember that when people tell you, of course, we couldn't possibly have elections. There had been elections. She'd won them. And there'd been a state commission of inquiry. And it had already come out with this first round of findings that there is no inquiry. There is no election. You're dealing with somebody who just will cling on with Netanyahu. And I'm not sure that Israeli politics has sort of adapted to who this person is. The usual rules do not apply.
Okay, so now very much in the present, we have finally brought together two dear friends of this podcast. We're actually very good friends of each other. And we want to talk to them, I think, about what is going on, but also how we all continue to live in the shadow of this war and these threats.
Ira Glass is a giant of American broadcasting, the founder and editor of This American Life, and thought by many to be the man who transformed speech radio and indeed the podcast with his work.
I just want to really underline again that I'm going to be the very least informed person in this conversation about Israel. I feel like a little bit scared that I'm an amateur newsreader on with three people who are actually so deeply informed. So
I don't think any part of that is true, but we will make it very smooth sailing.
Edgar Keret is a superstar of the Israeli literary scene. He's a writer, a filmmaker, internationally published author. His work has been translated into over 4 dozen languages. His Substack posts have kept me sane for the past 6 months. His stories are sad and funny and absurd and unforgettable. And Edgar and Ira have been friends for 20 years. At least that's what Edgar says. I can ask Ira for his version.
I'm bad with numbers, but around, right?
It's basically true, yes. Could we just hear your micing again one more time?
Yeah, Edgar, it's just that my neighbors are making noise, so I close the window.
Okay. First fact corroborated. We wanted to talk to them about their friendship and about the shadow that the war is casting, perhaps on that friendship, but definitely on storytelling and definitely on life. So thank you for the two of you for coming on together. This has been a dream of ours for a while, and we're really glad you can make it happen.
Thanks.
Edgar, if you could get closer to your microphone, that would be better.
Yes.
I'm so sorry to say these words because I'm a crazy person, okay? And sometimes one can't stop oneself.
So we'll start with you, Edgal, because we're the Tel Avivians or the Israelis in the conversation, and we're sitting here having a semi-normal conversation when everyone here is talking about one thing, which is the imminent Iranian strike. I just want to talk about how crazy that kind of feels, right? Then you're looking at your diary next week saying, oh, I have 3 work meetings and a doctor's appointment, unless there's war with Iran. Like, let's talk a little bit about how insane that is.
Yes, but first of all, I don't think it's a first. You know, I've sent you a chapter from a book of mine, The 7 Good Years, in which there was exactly the same situation with Ahmadinejad, you know, and where this idea of saying, wow, they're going to attack for sure. Let's not pay for the rent. Maybe they'll kill us before the 15th. You know, all those kind of feelings that we're in a limbo and that our fate will be defined at some moment. And we're now just sitting like you're in an airport waiting for a plane. This time doesn't count. It's really after something happened, we will report what's going on. So it's something that I'm familiar with. I think that after the 7th of October, actually for me, it kind of works less. You know, it's kind of like after There is something about this this trauma of this war in general that it kind of lifted the bar. You know, I mean, if my fear would be, if there would be such an attack, oh my God, I hope that nobody that I know will get killed, then people that I knew got killed, you know, and I would hope that this will not happen again. But this idea that it's not, it wouldn't be a categorical change. It wouldn't be something that I haven't experienced. You know, I honestly don't think that the Iranian attack will be worse than the 7th of October, which means that I don't fantasize about it. I say pragmatically, if it happens, I'm not happy about it, but let's move on.
So, Ira, you and me are not bracing ourselves. We're not having to pile up canned food in the safe room because we're outside Israel. So I think you and I, at least, can talk about how it's been watching this from afar, that not just this latest Iranian development, but the whole thing. In an email just before, when we were sort of setting this up, you said that you and Etgar had been talking, and one thing we've noticed is that early in the war, we were further apart in our views, and our conversations were more like people shouting over a wall at each other. And that's changed over time. Now we're closer on our views. And I'm interested to know two big things, really. Where you were when there was some distance on October 7th, and where you are now. And in a way, I mean, after, you know, hear from you first, but it would be interesting to hear Edgar's take on that too.
Well, where we were was, I would talk to Edgar, and for the first time in our friendship, I felt like we were seeing a political situation differently, or something in the news differently. And I mean, it's funny because there are two parts to it, and one of them was purely emotional, had nothing to do with politics. I think a lot of us who are not in Israel, talking to people we love in Israel in the immediate aftermath of the attack, just absorbing what its meaning was for people in Israel, you know, that just took a second. Like in every conversation, I just felt very aware of the trauma, like every person I talked to in Israel, not just Edgar, was going through, and then just really recalibrating my sense of what it meant. Like that was a thing. And I don't know, that's a common thing I think a lot of people went through. And but then when it came to the way the war was being prosecuted from the beginning, you know, I just saw it in a way that was fundamentally different. You know, I saw it through a different lens. And one of the things actually that I've appreciated about what the two of you have done on the Unholy podcast is I feel like it's the only place that I've been able to turn to where I witnessed two people going through what I felt like what I was going through with Edgar and with other people who I've talked to in Israel, where the two of you have talked explicitly about the gap between how you were seeing it, Jonathan, how you were seeing it, Yonit. And in our case, from the beginning, I was saying things to Edgar that are very similar, Jonathan, to what you were saying to Yonit on the podcast of like, okay, I understand the need to eradicate Hamas, but why not let medicine into the country? Like why not? That doesn't seem humane, and also it's a bad look. It's bad for Israel, you know. And I was really surprised when Edgar would just say like, well, maybe it's a, I remember Edgar, you saying like, well, maybe it's like a little too much force here or there. Maybe they're destroying a few too many buildings. But like, and I don't know the right amount, but it seems like it's going to take a lot. Like you very much were like, maybe the little excessives here or there, but like this is, seems like basically what we've got to do because it's in a unique situation where militants are dug in tunnels and there's no way to get at them. And, you know, you just ran through all the arguments on why this much force and this extraordinary amount of destruction and civilian death, you know, may be called for. And I had the experience of feeling like my friend Edgar is one of the most famously liberal people in the country. And I felt like, you know, like, and if listeners don't know, like, you know, like the things you write and the things you say in public and your wife, Shira, like, you know, you both are like two of the most left-leaning, peace, you know, facing people in the country. I was like, oh, if Etgar's saying that, that's pretty much the whole country. Like, if Etgar's with Netanyahu on this one, that's basically, we're at 100%. You know, like, there might be a few people somewhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Etgar, you could tell me how wrong I am or something if I'm mischaracterizing. But, like, but anyway, like, you should correct that. But that's always been my sense as somebody who doesn't live in the country but sees your public statements. And that was new and sobering, and actually sent me to immersing myself actually in like deeper reading of Haaretz and other English language stuff. And there was a whole point where like I asked an Israeli relative here for links to like stuff to look at online, and you know what I mean? And so there was a real gap. And then as the war has continued, I didn't realize it at first, but like I realized at some point recently, like, oh, no, we're getting much closer to looking at things the same way. Mm-hmm. I don't know, Etgar, you should pick up the story or
yeah.
Pick your side.
Okay, so now I tell you how it really happened. No,
exactly.
The thing was that I want to say that, you know, that since the war it started, I found myself hyperventilating like crazy because basically, like, I had activities on the level of helping a friend that her father was in the party in the Nova, go through ER and find out if her father is dead or kidnapped, you know, talking to somebody very close that they're still shooting on her brother and children apartment, like dealing with this stuff on the one end, and also giving dozens of interviews on the other. And I think that there was this really, sometimes it felt like this huge gap, because when I would give interviews, I must say in the first few weeks of the war, there were two modes. There were people who were like super empathic and came to listen. And they were more like kind of therapists than journalists, you know? And there were people who basically came and said, like, you know, the alleged massacre, there are no proof. Why do you keep saying beheading of people? No one was beheaded. It's really, I remember, after a long and frustrating interview, you know, I went to the balcony to lit a joint. I can legally smoke. You know,
it's medicinal.
I have a permit. Okay. And while I was lighting the joint, I hear the neighbors from the other door. I hear the little boy crying, and he says, "Don't lie to me! Don't lie to me! We both know that Daddy loves the IDF more than he loves me." Oh, wow. You know, so it's really like this kind of feeling. People going in the street, neighbors that I know for 20 years, shouting to me to come out because they want to do a guard watch. And they want everybody to have rifle in Tel Aviv, you know. There is this feeling of kind of lunacy that I think that it's kind of a downgrade of humanity in that sense, that the first thing that kind of goes out of the window is your curiosity. And then with it, all kind of a sense of a containing or being able to deal with obscurity or ambiguity. It's basically like, everything is very, very simple. And I think that into this very kind of almost simplistic reality came my conversations with Ira. And suddenly it didn't work because I had the menu, I have the model, and it didn't work because I know supporting friends that call me and say, yes, Etgar, whatever you're saying, yeah, you're so right. We love you. You write such nice, beautiful short stories. You're also very handsome. And so I had those talks, you know, and I had talks with people who were really, really unempathetic, didn't give a fuck about anything that happened here. And they were kind of nagging me. And there come I got Ira, and he wasn't this kind of a priorically supportive person. And at the same time, while he was annoying, I can give an example. You know, for example, me and Ira had a very long talk in which Ira, listening to somebody in the Obama administration that compared the attack on Gaza to the attack on Mosul in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And Ira said, you know, they did that. But I say, yeah, but you know, ISIS came there 3 months before. Hamas has been there for 17 years. You know, in Mosul, they didn't have a hospital with tunnels going under it and coming out on a 7-Eleven 5 kilometers from there. It's not the same. So I had this kind of feeling that there was something in the narrative that I disagreed with. But at the same time, I felt that here I'm meeting a guy who's curious, who kind of likes me, and who's trying to understand what's going on, and not somebody who's like kind of like, you know, like the Gutierrez thing, you know, saying, oh yeah, all those people died massacres, but let's not forget it didn't happen in a vacuum. Netanyahu can say now, oh, all those children die in Gaza, but let's not forget it happened in the vacuum. It happened after the 7th of October. This is not a good way to deal with something. Like, I mean, when you say, wow, this is horrible, you know, I mean, I've been talking for about occupation and against it and demonstrating for 30 years, but I thought that in the week of October 7th, it would be a good time to talk about it less. Gutierrez thought that this was the high time of it. So I'm saying I didn't come from there. But at the same time, I really, really felt that sometimes he didn't know things, that he knew less. But when he was talking, I very quickly understood that he didn't know less. He just knew other things. And I want to say that in the beginning, my instinct was all the time to consume Israeli media, you know, to see on it and to see the other channels and to read the Israeli papers. And then suddenly I realized that Ira mentioned all kinds of facts that I was unaware of because they were not in the Israeli TV, you know. So I had to go to Guardian to read how many children were in Gaza were amputated. You know, I had to go to there to read about AI that, you know, that Israel had been using. And I bet that all those things could be found in Hebrew, but the main narrative was totally different. And so wait, and in yes.
No, I want to say something about Israeli television as the only representative of Israeli television. I'll do that in a few minutes, but I am interested in your friendship and your relationship, because obviously a lot of what you have been going through, you know, we have been going through in the same way, I think. And I'm interested in Ira and his perspective on this. Did you feel at any point before Etzgal, when Etzgal was only listening to Israeli television, did you feel like there was some sort of, I don't want to say danger to your friendship, but any way of which you were sort of looking at this saying maybe whatever we were building this on for 20 years was wrong? Or that it didn't come to that moment?
No. But I felt like it was just hard. It was just, you know, it was just hard to connect and I don't know. It was a challenge. Yeah. I think we're both saying like we would kind of leave those conversations sort of being like, huh, what's that about? And it did make me go back. And Edgar, you're saying, I mean, I didn't know this until this week when you and I talked about it to prepare for coming to this conversation. I didn't realize that it sent you going to other sources. And then just to pick up on what you're saying, Edgar, this is a maybe kind of a little footnotey or something, but the story about Mosul that you're talking about was this is actually a story that I heard on Unholy where Jonathan, you mentioned an American general who had been advising the Israeli government and had been going over and talking to the IDF and had been saying, well, when in America, like what our doctrine was in Iraq was we were very, very clear. We tried to be very clear. With the civilian population, we're fighting this militant group. We're not fighting you. And so if we would take over a town, there was an infrastructure that would go in to provide medical help and rebuild any power supplies and just rebuild infrastructure with the message, you know, we're fighting ISIS. We're fighting these guys. We are not fighting the civilian population. And he said that he presented this to the IDF of like, this is what you all should do.
And the situation is not different. It is so different because when ISIS take over a city, it's not as if when the people of Gaza had been living under Hamas and under occupation for so long, getting all the social services from there. I'm saying it's not the same situation. The fact that it's not the same situation doesn't mean as if this government is... and the army, but I think it's the government is responsible, didn't blunder this thing totally. I mean, think about the crazy situations that we're in. First of all, I'm saying it's crazy the idea of, let's say, not giving humanitarian help. But I'm saying that in the first week, everybody said, okay, relax, we have a plan. We're going to do something. We're going to be done by December, January, but we're going to do something. You know, Netanyahu says total victory. But I say, okay, I don't believe Netanyahu, but they probably have some kind of plan. You know, now 6 months later, it seems that the only plan was to keep Netanyahu's government intact. And when you talk about humanitarian help, you know, we had to talk about that.
Keep it intact, you mean by keeping the war going.
Keeping the war going. And also the fact is that, you know, the Hamas, very much like the Netanyahu's partner, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, they see a future in which only one people live here. You know, they're arguing who God promised this country to, but basically Ben-Gvir in the long run and Sinwar in the long run, they don't see a two-state solution. And that's what made Netanyahu make such a strong pact with the Hamas. The PA, the Palestinian Authority, you know, they are enemies, we fight with them, but they are agreeing to a solution that Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, and Netanyahu at this stage will not take. So I'm saying...
Wait, can I just interrupt for a second? This is the thing that changed, can I say, over the 6 months. Mm-hmm. Eckhart, that you explained to me this week, and I hadn't quite realized what happened, is that what happened is the way the war went, your views on the war became so much more negative, and your doubt of the government and the war plan became so much more negative that we were much closer together. Mm-hmm. Like I could say to you things, we could talk about the fact that of the famine in Gaza, and we would have the same point of view on it, instead of before, where I think you would have defended.
No.
The famine is just like a whole other thing. But do you know what I mean? But I feel like when we talk about the war now, I feel like you're so much more critical of it because of the way the war has progressed. Like the 6 months have gone so terribly, and the lack of progress has been so evident that now kind of facts have pushed you towards a position that's much more the way it looks to me out here in the diaspora.
So before you come back, Eckhart, I just want to ask Ira something, because what you've described there, Ira, is Eckhart moving towards you and your position. And I want to know if over these 6 months, Eckhart's saying no, we'll hear from him in a second, but have you felt yourself any movement in the other direction? Something where over the course of the 6 months or even in the first few days, the initial instincts and responses you had shifted, partly because of your conversations with Eckhart, or was the movement really only in one direction?
I changed in the following way. Like Eckhart would give a different context for things. So the things that I hadn't heard that would change the way that I saw them. And that happened a lot. So for example, if you remember when those photos came out, kind of early-ish in the war, of Palestinian prisoners who had been stripped and were bent over and were being loaded into, you know, a truck or something. You know, here in the United States, like I had friends sending me to these and just being like, can you believe the Israelis? Can you believe they're doing this? Like, what is this? And that's what it looked like from here in the United States. And then, I mean, people were really shocked by that. And Eckhart, I remember we had a talk where you said, like, well, one of the tactics that the IDF is using is to just say, like, is to send the message to the world. I mean, this is the argument the way I understood it anyway.
No,
if I'm characterizing it wrong, that basically, like, that a photo like that has value, military value, because it says to the world, like, if you fuck with us, we're going to fuck with you harder. And there are parts of Israel, you explained, where it was seen as like, let's get that photo out. Let's let everybody see it. You fuck with us, we fuck with you. And that's good. That's good for the Jews. Like, that's good for Israel to get that out, that there's a part of Israel. And it's like, honestly, I never would have understood that yeah, that could so be a tactic.
I really feel that I shouldn't take Ira as my publicist because he almost says he almost says what I said, but in a way that makes me sound worse. But no,
because, well, you didn't say that you necessarily saw it that way, but you said that
no,
think about
our talk. Basically, is that I say something and then you say something that I allegedly said. And then I say something, and then you say another thing that I allegedly said. You know, in this rate, it will almost start going to the stuff where I start saying stuff about you that you allegedly said. So beware.
Please correct what I'm saying wrong. Yeah, I misinterpreted it wrong.
So the talk was, first of all, we talked about the idea, why do they strip them? And then I said that I understood that some of them have bombs on them. So that's the reason that they strip them. And then Ira said, but why are they taking photos of it? And it's horrible. And I said, probably, you know, the strategical thought behind it is that it's kind of a retaliation move, saying, you know, we can be tough if you be this and you'll be trapped. Now, it wasn't like that I saying, and I think it's an amazing move. And when I say things of sense, when I say something of sense, you always lean forward and then there is an echo like you're doing it now. So I'm saying, I'm up for debates, but you're not playing fair. You're not playing fair.
The echo is Ira's fault. We just want to know.
Yeah, no, listeners no,
know
no, I'm saying.
It's his fault while you're talking. No, but it's an interesting thing that you remember the same conversation a little bit differently about that picture. It's a very interesting thing. I do want to ask you two about, we can continue talking about the war and still the war, but about storytelling during the war, because you two are master storytellers. And one thing for you, Edgar, is I remember reading, and it was very striking about you going through the communities that were so badly hurt by this calamity of October 7th, and you're reading stories to them. And you said how, on the one hand, it's ridiculous to be reading stories, on the other hand, it's something that's comforting for them. So that's what I wanted to pick up with you. And Ira, you have been really dealing with October 7th in this American life, in all kinds of parts of it. You spoke to a Palestinian called, one of your producers spoke to Yusuf Hamash, who was moving as a Palestinian who works for the Norwegian Refugee Council. He moved from, I think, Jabalia, and then he moved eventually to Rafah. And also you spoke to Michal and Lotan from Kibbutz Be'eri. Michal's mother and father, if I'm not mistaken, was murdered. So that was all part of the sort of you know, the pieces of the puzzle. And I'm interested in, since this is such a horrific tale, the beginning of it and maybe the rest of it, how do you even begin to deal with these kinds of stories?
I mean, I can jump in. Like, you know, our show, we're doing a very particular kind of journalism where we're looking for stories that unfold like little movies. Like, it's not daily news. We're not breaking news. And so for us, we approach this war the way we approach anything, which is we need to find people in a situation that unfolds over time and we can just watch what happens to them, and their situation is arresting in a way where you want to see what happens to them. You know, in the case of Yusuf, you know, the thing that was interesting was he was trying to get his family to move south to Rafah, and they didn't want to go because his sister was pregnant and she didn't want to live in a tent. She wanted to have a bathroom for the last like months of her pregnancy. And he just thought, like, if you stay in Khan Yunis, like, you know, you could die and you got to move. And he has to talk them into it. And you just want to find out, like, is he going to talk them into it? And how's it going to go? And then with the family that I did from Be'eri, they were just trying to figure out where to live now because you know, they weren't sure if they ever wanted to go back to where her parents had been killed and, you know, so much had happened. And so, you know, and their kids wanted one thing and, you know, and there was a whole politics to the vote at Be'eri, which honestly is like such an amazing story that I wish I could have reported on in person about like how they chose where they would go. But anyway, but it was a thing where like there's so many feelings at stake and you want to watch it unfold. And it's a very actually specialized kind of story. One of the things that's hard is actually just even finding stories where you can get inside people's lives and they'll be open and you can take people in that way. Mm-hmm. But we don't approach that differently than we approach other stories.
Let's go.
I'm still in the 7th of October. I want to say something that I wanted to say before mm-hmm. Jonathan asked Ira a question, that if I try to understand the process that I've been going through, is basically, first of all, you know, I think that from the first moment I was very critical of many things, but at the same time there was this kind of feeling that you're in a survival mode, that, you know, if somebody says to you, run for shelter, and you say, but they're not shooting, you know, then it could be too late. So first you run to shelter and then you try to figure out what's going on. But I think that the main feeling is that, let's say, it's like getting in, having an operation. So having an operation is very aggressive. It's violent. They cut your body. Something bad can happen to you. But the doctor comes and says, listen, we need this operation. You know, there are kidnapped people. We need to find our place in the region. We're going in. And then the moment that you understand that the people who are dressed as doctors and open you up, they have no plan, no idea. They don't know what they're doing. They're basically killing terrorists, you know, with no end to it. And then suddenly all kinds of issues, you know, become crucial, because of course in war there is collateral damage, but there is a collateral damage which should be contained on the way to a goal. But if what you have is just a series of attacks that disproportionately hurt a lot of civilians, then you say, you know what, I'm not having an operation with somebody who doesn't promise me that I'll get better in the end.
You know, your very first sentence there, that you're still in October the 7th, I think that could point up maybe what puts me and Ira in one place and you two, Edgar and Yonid, in another, which is, I mean, in terms of what we're all learning from each other, the thing that I really have got in talking with Yonid, you know, week after week through this, is the extent to which, and it's now been, several people have said it, but I heard it directly when I was in the country, which is, this isn't post-trauma, this is trauma. You know, we're not suffering from PTSD, we're in TSD. You know, this is still going on now. Whereas I think, and it's something Yoni and I have talked about, the particular place of a diaspora Jew is to feel some of that, not all of it, but a big part of that, and simultaneously be exposed to all the other narratives from inside Gaza, the thing, Edgar, you said you had to seek out. So we have naturally CNN and the New York Times and the Guardian just around. But Ira, because, you know, you and I are both on the outside, do you think that is something, well, I'm going to be very direct about it. Do you on some level feel a bit guilty when you talk to Edgar about not, whatever, however much you empathize, you can't feel the intensity of October the 7th the way he does?
I don't feel guilty, but I feel the gap for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't feel guilt over that gap. I just feel a sense of like, oh, my friend's going through a thing, you know?
Yeah. But I think it was that sort of our exposure to sort of the double narrative, both what was going on in Israel and how the world was seeing it, which created a sort of gap between us and
also just the fact that I think you're leaving out an important factor, and that's just like the difference between feeling that something is an existential threat to you. Like, in some abstract way, a threat against the state of Israel is a threat against me as a Jew in America. But a bunch of dominoes have to fall before that feels like a direct emotional thing. And, you know, just put in the simplest way, I mean, when that attack happened on October 7th, it was horrific. But I didn't feel like I personally was threatened. My world was personally threatened in a way that every single person who I know and care about in Israel seemed to feel. That's the profound difference.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. I think that, and for me, it was translated into a slight feeling of guilt because it was worse for them than for us, putting it very directly.
I want to say, I don't know, I can't speak for Yonid, but I want to say that my entire sensation through the 7th of October was how lucky I was. You know, my son is not in the army yet, he's gonna enlist later on. The people that I knew in this kibbutz were not there that week. But I can tell you that something tiny. So it's almost kind of very close to this feeling that you lose control. Like, I mean, you're in control, but it's, you're not thinking anymore. You're just kind of feeling and sensing, and all kinds of things are getting mixed up in your mind. And in the, and I'm saying the worst thing is that when you go outside and you talk to somebody that doesn't understand it, you try to reduce it to something lucid. You don't say, hey, I'm crazy. You say you don't understand anything. And I had this experience, I think about a week ago, I wrote about it in a piece for the Israeli paper, that I saw the Saturday Night Live Remy Yusuf monologue. And in the beginning, he says, free Palestine. And everybody go, ah, you know. And I say, okay. Anti-Israeli, New York, you know. That's the stuff. And then he said, free the kidnapped people in Gaza. And everybody go, yay. And I said, oh my God, they're not anti-Israelis, they're just pro-human. When they see people oppressed, they want them to have their freedom. When they see people kidnapped, they want them released. When they see people dying, they want them to stop. But you're so much in kind of compressed into something that is one-dimensional. Like, are you for me? Are you against me? Is it good for us? Is it bad for us? And this is the wall that needs to be broken. You know, that's the thing. I must say that most of my arguments and conversation that I have with people around me is about the fact that I shouted them that you have people saying, you know, Gaza is not my concern. I don't want to think about children in Gaza. I don't want to think. And I say, you know, you occupy a territory. You're responsible for it. And I want you to think about all the hungry and dead children in the world, not only in Gaza. When you finish thinking about the ones in Gaza, think about the one in the Ukraine, okay? I'm not done with you. No, you know, you cannot let those doors close in your face. And this is the biggest threat. And I want to say that the place where I feel those closed doors the most, sorry for saying that, you need, but it's in the Israeli media and news.
I have to say something about Israeli media, can I? Okay. First of all, and this is me on the record saying it, it's okay to close the television once in a while. Just say. You have me as giving you the author. I'm kidding about that. Let me say something to you, Edgal, about this. There is no handbook written on how to broadcast this kind of disaster. Never in the world, in the Western world that we like to think that we're part of, has any country dealt with what we dealt with on October 7th. Nowhere. 9/11 doesn't come close to the cruelty, the barbarity of what we saw. And we are dealing every day, just as our network, okay? But I assume everyone else, with questions that come from the darkest places of hell. Really, how much would you show of the atrocities that Hamas actually filmed on October 7th? How much do you show of the psychological warfare that they're waging against Israel, filming the hostages in captivity? How much do you show of Gaza, which is a big question that we ask? I'll also tell you, and maybe we should tell people who listen outside Israel, that in the first days and weeks that this happened, where every institution in this country collapsed, the military, the government, everyone, the address people had was television that listened to them. So I'm not trying to tell you that your concerns are wrong or misplaced. I'm just trying to tell you that we're having these conversations every day. And I think a lot of what you're saying, you're seeing, I admit that in a time of war, the stretch of what is legitimate is or said on television is probably, you know, very expanded. And there are some things that I would comment on. Maybe other people wouldn't. I'm not going into my specifics. I'm just saying that serious people who are working hard and who are dealing with things they've never seen in their life up close are having these conversations. Maybe the answer they're giving to themselves is not the answer you want to hear. I'm just saying that we are trying as best as we can. I have to say that, not because I work in this place and that they pay my salary. I'm saying it just as the most authentic way. Obviously, there are things that I can or can't talk about because it's the inner sort of trappings of what we're talking about every day. But just know that we are having these conversations. What you're saying is not at all sort of thrown out in the air of, sorry, I took the conversation a different way. I just wanted to sort of
But I think it's a very interesting way that you took it, because what I want to say, I don't think that the people in the news, I don't know, they're doing a bad job or trying to take us to another place. But what I think is that, like all of us, we were very, very scared on the 7th of October. And when you're scared, you try to keep to your safe zones. Now, when you live in a country in Israel that was ripped for a year because we have a right-wing government that basically everything human being said, you know, is attacked. You know, my wife contributed a sofa to Palestinians. We almost got death threats for that, you know. So I'm saying it's really, so in such close environment, when you try to be safe, it's almost like trying to project to the audience saying, all of you, you want to lynch somebody? Not me. I'm with you. Let's say something that will appease the crazy ones. Because on TV, there are those 10% trolls that will start saying that I'm assisting an enemy or something. So I'm saying, I think it's a process of self-censorship. It's a process of kind of going to the safe and well-known places. And in the bottom line, I'm saying, how many should be shown from Gaza? I would say 10 times more with what we see now. I mean, the idea is that a TV, for example, they show you a drone is shooting a missile on a terrorist. You know, it's basically, you know, I saw 50 of those movies on TV. This is not news for me. Tell me that one terrorist died, it's okay. I mean, this is not a reality show in which I see people blowing up. You know, this is not a Monty Python sketch. You know, it gives me zero information. While showing stuff in Gaza, and even when you show stuff in Gaza, many times it's in the context, it's like almost people calling them and say, what do you think about Israel? What the hell is going on? You know, where are you? You know, is your family safe? And this is something that, again, you know, maybe it takes a process. You know, I think that I'm now more lucid than I was 3 months ago, and that 3 months ago I was more lucid than I was 6 months ago. But I'm saying that for now, I feel that the television is showing a very distorted image of reality.
Ira, I'm just thinking of what Yonit said about nobody's ever had to deal with this before, even just at the level of journalism and telling stories. This is probably where we're going to have to wind things up. But I'm just thinking, you listening to this, and when you listen to your friend at Gal, when you're speaking with him, is that right that they are going through something that no other country has really had to wrestle with before?
Well, I mean, I respect the feeling behind it, but immediately as a reporter, my mind started going to, like, I just think of Myanmar, you know, not that long
Rwanda.
Ago when,
yeah,
yeah, no, like, so things have happened, but like, you know, I don't know if people have been doing nightly newscasts where they were free enough to actually make choices in those countries. So I don't, you know, like, I think that there have been obviously other atrocities around the world. I just think, I don't know if there have been broadcasters who've been in the situation.
Yeah, I meant to say that the vantage point I was trying to say is that this kind of barbarity and sadism on the territory of a Western country, or a country that wants to consider itself a Western country. And I'm not saying there were never ever massacres in the world besides, just the fact that we sort of have to broadcast this as a journalistic place that does journalism at the high, I think, at the highest way. But we don't want to get into, I don't think we need to get into the sort of...
But I want to say one thing about the uniqueness of this incident. I think is that there are many, many killings and fights, but usually, again, there is a strategical plan behind it. So what's happening in 7th of October, it had no end game. They just came, killed a lot of people and left. Now, the war in Gaza seems to look the same. It's really like as if Yihya Sinwar and Netanyahu are playing such a weird game of chess in which they're doing stuff that you can't understand rationally. You know, I mean, no war had been won by you killing all the soldiers of the other armies. That's not how you win a war. It doesn't work, you know. But the fact is that the strong feeling is this feeling of senselessness. Because if somebody does something that doesn't make any sense and that's going to cause his own destruction, but he still does that, it makes you more anxious because you don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know where those people are all aspiring to, you know.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
You can ask, but we will not answer.
We'll answer you with another question. Go ahead.
Very Jewish. So you know, one of the things that I've really enjoyed in the Unholy podcast is just listening to the two of you, you know, and the difference between, like, the way that you're seeing things. And I know that's the premise of the podcast, but it's really played out in such a dramatic way since the war. And I'm wondering, as the war has progressed, have the two of you had the same experience that Edgar and I have had, where it feels like the gap between you has lessened?
You're very good at this. You might consider doing it as a career, Ira. Do you want to answer that, Jonathan?
I don't know if it's worked quite the same way. I think it's, you know, people heard on our podcast are differences as we were airing things. But I think there is a coming together because of this point I was trying to sort of grope towards before about understanding and realizing the depth and intensity of what Israelis went through, which, you know, however much I could sort of intellectually process it, I think it's through speaking with Yonit week after week that I sort of realize how that misses quite a lot, and it misses the actual feeling that is left after an experience like October the 7th. And so that for me has been a big part of it. The notion that Israel is still in it and therefore can't really, you know, be detached about this subject in a way that maybe it's easier for people outside. So I think that's a big part of it. I was putting to you, Ira, I wondered, you know, how much it's a two-way street. You know, it takes two of you to move. So, you know, Yonit, you've got to tell us what you think.
I think that Jonathan actually said it rather beautifully in the episode that we called War Therapy. He said, I realized that the country was in mourning. And when you're in mourning, right, essentially the whole country was sitting Shiva. And the feeling of anyone asking something when, you know, Jonathan came in and started talking about humanitarian aid at the very beginning, it kind of felt to me like, heaven forbid, your brother is dead and you're sitting Shiva and someone comes in and says, well, why did he have to cross the street in red light? You know, but you're sitting, you're mourning. And you can't, the emotional ability to even hear any sort of criticism was very, very limited. And I kind of think to myself now that maybe there are certain things that, you know, he saw before I did, which may be me admitting that sometimes he's right, which annoys me. So I'm going to be very brief about this. but there are certain things that he did see. There are other things. It's more complicated, I think, because I think there are issues when it comes to, I'm not going to open up a whole new topic here, but when it comes to that issue of anti-Semitism and tying in Israel's actions to the reactions then, you know, received by Jews around the world. Those are places where I have more of a difficulty, you know, talking about and hearing some of the things that Jonathan said and still thinks. You know, I think the short answer to your question would be we probably need to have a war therapy episode too. But the longer answer is that in some places we did, I think, grow closer and others were still very much apart. Does that make sense?
It does to me, which is half of it or a quarter of it, looking at the four of us in this call. And I was going to just connect one last thing perhaps to what Edgar said earlier about the lack of a plan. I think that point, it really did take our conversations with, you know, Yonit and I for me to make understand this point about a nation in mourning and that you don't start jabbing and poking at someone who's sitting Shiva. And I think that is, I needed to hear that. My problem, I think, is now, I get why the country is still in that place, but I expect more of leaders. I think leaders have to transcend that. They have to be able to get beyond the trauma and emotion. They have to be able to make decisions about the strategic health of the country in the long term. So they need to be able to say, I feel all this rage and grief, but I'm going to think beyond it. And I get why ordinary people in the street can't do that. But I don't think the people in the very top making the decisions have any justification for failing to do that. So that goes to Edgar's point in a way about the fury that there isn't an actual plan. We could all talk for so much longer. I feel as if we've only just begun it. You two will carry on having your conversations, I'm sure, and Yonit and I definitely will here. I'm just extremely grateful that you allowed us to sort of eavesdrop on this ongoing dialogue that the two of you are having. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Ira, I'm going to talk to you later.
I know. I'm so sorry. Can I just apologize for any misrepresentations? Anything I said about Edgar's point of view, please know that it might that be
his point
wrong.
Of view is much nicer than I claim.
We are leaving all of this in, my friends. All of it stays in the conversation.
Of course, of course.
As long as we all register that Jonathan called me ordinary people on the street, as long as we're down with that, we're good.
Ordinary people?
Mm-hmm. See, Edgar didn't hear it because I didn't say it, Yonit.
She's extraordinary. You know, I mean, like, you can't say about Yonit. Come on.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks so much, guys. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Well, we thought that would be wonderful to, as I said just at the end, to kind of eavesdrop on this real friendship. And I think it was. I mean, just you could hear them interacting with each other and sort of contradicting each other and arguing with each other. And I think the question we both feared did come, throwing it back to us. But I think we managed to swerve most of that. It was fascinating to listen to them, wasn't it?
I think so. I listened to Edgar and Ira on stage. They are really master of the storytelling. And the fact that they are friends and such good friends for such a long time, to hear them having the same conversation I assume so many friends have been having over the past 6 months, articulating that for us, I mean, that was really a unique experience. I'm very glad to have had them on.
Yeah, and how kind and generous of Ira to say that much of what they were saying over these 6 months was echoed in the conversations you and I were having, that he found a kind of resonance there. And in a way, that's a big part of why we're doing this, for that dialogue that goes on between Israelis and diaspora Jews. And they're doing it, we're doing it. And of course, it's not going to end here. Those two will carry on talking just as you and I are. We should hand out our awards. Before we do, a little correction about one of our award winners a couple of weeks back. We nominated Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman from New York, because a little bit of video was doing the rounds on social media showing AOC apparently stumped by some pretty basic questions about the Israel-Palestine conflict. It turns out, and we should have made this clearer, that the video was not current, even though it was newly viral, but instead dated back to 2018. So very glad to clear that up. On to this week's awards, and the Chutzpah Award might go to Amnesty International for a tweet they did this week, noting the death in custody of Walid Dakka, who they described as a 62-year-old Palestinian writer who was the longest-serving Palestinian prisoner in Israeli jails. The quibble there might be with the word writer, because I think people looking at that tweet would think, wow, so this person was obviously held in prison for his writing, some kind of dissident figure. It's slightly glossed over the fact that the reason Walid Dakka was in jail was he was convicted of leading a cell of terrorists that committed murder, and in particular, not just any murder, but the murder of a 19-year-old Israeli, Moshe Tamam, who was, by this terror group, castrated, had his eyes gouged out, he was mutilated, and then shot. And that is why Walid Dakka was in prison as long as he was, not for being a writer. So I think a little bit of license there in the wording warrants a Chutzpah Award for Amnesty International, slightly for glossing over the crimes for which Walid Dakka was actually a prisoner.
Can I give my Mensch Award of the Week? I actually
Please
had two.
Please do. No, you must.
I will be, first of all, to the brave men and women of Kibbutz Nir Oz. Kibbutz Nir Oz is probably the black hole of October 7th, the most terrible story of all terrible stories, because this is a kibbutz that one out of four of its members has either been kidnapped or murdered on October 7th. And in fact, the terrorists managed to go inside and outside the kibbutz for a few raids before anyone figured out what was going on. The Bibas family have probably the most famous hostages kidnapped from Nir Oz. The members of Nir Oz went back to their communal dining hall, and everyone who knows kibbutzim knows that's a very important meeting place, to have a seder, a pre-seder, before Pesach, for the hostages, the 36 hostages still held in Gaza. And I guess this is an opportunity, really, to talk about the bravery of these people, of the fact that they managed to somehow continue, because their lives are incomplete, but to live their lives in the meantime and fight for their friends and neighbors and family members who need to be released. Another shout out, if I may, to a friend of the pod, Scott Galloway. Do listen to his conversation on this podcast, episode 136, called Scott Galloway versus the World. He is also in Israel visiting the sites. The Nova Festival site is what I picked up on in his social media. And I think the importance of people actually coming here, everyone who comes here to see and to meet the people and see what Israel went through. I think that is an extremely important thing for us. And so that is another kind of mensch award of the week.
Worthy choices indeed. We will see each other again next week. I say that with some hope, Yoni, because if there is a huge emergency, as some of those reports suggest, then we will obviously be back for that.
We will indeed. In the meantime, we will say our thank yous to Gaia Glaser, Omer Primatz, and Omri Barak. And don't this take this the wrong way, Jonathan. I hope we meet only next week and not before.
I understand that completely, and no offense taken. See you then.
See ya.